Hey everybody, welcome to this Into the Dark podcast only extrasode. You know, one of the features of doing Into the Dark with Radio Free Brooklyn as a live radio stream radio show before it becomes a podcast is that every episode has to be 59 minutes, no more, no less, on the dot. So sometimes we can't get to everything that I want to talk about and give everything its justice, but I wanted to record this addendum about selling your soul to the devil just because we were only able to talk about it a little bit in the last episode, and it really deserves a stronger, deeper, wider look. So I'm recording this extra episode not in the Radio Free Brooklyn studios in Bushwick, Brooklyn, but in my own apartment here in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. So you might hear a bit of street noise, but as long as you hear the facts as well, that's really what matters. So the question that sort of brought all this up with Pacts of the Devil is actually a fairly long and complicated one, and so we're only going to address the first half of it today, and that is, dear Into the Dark, I have heard that if you enter into a contract as a minor, you can legally back out of the contract within the first 6 months of your majority, 18 years of age. Does this mean you can sell your soul as a minor and then reap the benefits, fame, fortune, Manhattan real estate, with the secure knowledge that you can back out once you reach adulthood? Are there historical records of people entering into soul-conferring contracts, or just stories about, for instance, Faust or Robert Johnson? What's the evidence on Robert Johnson? Great question. Thank you so much for sending it in. And just a reminder, if you want your questions answered by Into the Dark, send them to intothedarkrfb@gmail.com. So the story of, or the idea of selling your soul to the devil is an old, old one. And it's suggested that its origin might actually be just the sort of notion that it's an inversion of the covenant, which is a fascinating thought, but like the first record of someone supposedly selling their soul to the devil is the story of Saint Theophilus of Adana, in which was written between probably 650 and 850 AD, who sold his soul with a contract that he signed with his own blood to get a bishopric. But then, of course, these stories keep popping up, and you have people like Faust. And the thing about Faust is that as much as he is an important literary figure, you know, appearing in Christopher Marlowe's Dr. Faustus or Goethe's epic poem Faust, he was actually a real fellow. You can sit in the New York Public Library on a Sunday afternoon or a Monday. Was I on a Saturday? It might have been a Tuesday. You can sit in the New York Public Library one afternoon, as I have done, and go through German municipal records of Georgius Faustus of Helmstadt getting kicked out of different places, or possibly fined. He got his MPhil at the University of Heidelberg in 1487, and then wandered around as a scholar and astrologer and necromancer. And the thing is, he starts popping up in people's letters, and when he first starts popping up, he is mostly dismissed, and his powers are not held to be that great. For example, in a letter from Conrad Mutianus to Rufus, from Conrad Mutianus Rufus to Heinrich Urbanus, written in 1513, he says that George Faust, the demigod of Heidelberg, is a braggart and a fool. But the thing is, Martin Luther starts talking about him, the head of the Protestant Reformation, and Martin Luther, who has at least one story of him dealing with someone selling the soul to the devil himself, said that Faust claimed that the devil was his brother-in-law. And then Martin Luther's successor, after he died in leading the Protestant Reformation, tells us that apparently at one point Faust tried to use the magic powers conferred on him by the devil to fly from Venice straight into heaven, but he only got part of the way there and then dropped out of the sky like a stone. He also tells us that apparently Faust uses magic powers to eat another magician in a cave, which is, I think we've gone on record in the show saying that, like, Into the Dark does not support cannibalism, but that's still pretty metal. And also the Lore Corum Communium Collect Ania of Johannes Manlius, says that Satan followed Faust as a dog. But either way, whether it's lore, legend, or a matter of deeper consideration, it is said that Faust met a very nasty end because of his pact with the devil, and that his body was torn to shreds, and he was essentially smeared across a room by the devil when the devil came to take his due. But these stories continue. The thing about like Faust is like there's sort of like a mixture of lore that it may or may not have actually been true, and there's also a mixture of actual records. But like the farther along you get with stuff like this, you do get more in the way of court documents and things like that. So there was a fellow named Urbain Grandier, who was a priest, who was put on trial after a whole convent of nuns was attacked by evil spirits, and they found that he had signed a contract with not only the devil, but a host of sort of infernal figures. So he signed a contract with Lucifer, Satan, Beelzebub, Leviathan, Elmimi, Astaroth, and, quote, others, end quote. And the contract itself was written by Baal Barith. And the thing is, this contract was written in backwards Latin in really gorgeous script. And I'm gonna post a link to a picture of this, because they found this contract. It was entered into evidence. And in the contract, he sold his soul to receive, quote, the love of women, the flower of virgins, respect of monarchs, honors, lusts, and powers. But for this, he ended up, I think, getting burned at the stake. There were also a number of trials in Sweden in the 16 and 1700s, because there it was illegal to sign a contract with the devil or make a pact with the devil. So a lot of people went on trial there. And this gets back to our question. Like, if you sign a contract with the devil, can you use the strictures of the legal system to get out of it? And we have a case that sort of weighs in on this. Anders Mattinson went on trial in 1694 for a contract he had with the devil that they found. And the court argued that he should get, I think, a lesser punishment than he would normally receive for the crime because the contract was not valid. Anders Mattinson hadn't signed it and he hadn't dated it. So it should be understood that maybe signing a contract with the devil, there is a lot of bearing on whether it is in fact a proper contract and whether it would actually be binding, which, fantastic. So, like, consider this, I think, before entering into a contract with the devil. I think I would like to go on record saying don't do that, because it is very risky, and it can be very Twilight Zone-y, I might understand, where, you know, you ask for a thing, but then you get in a way where you can't use it, you don't want it, like, you know, you ask for eternal youth, and you end up just being turned into a baby, forever. But, yeah, so there is an understanding that you can potentially get out of the contract via the way it relates to the laws in the jurisdiction in which you are operating. There is also something to be said for, a lot of the lore around pacts of the devil indicates that the devil needs to actually present you with his copy of the contract to collect his due. So if you can get that contract away from the devil, he has no legal standing. For example, Saint Theophilus of Adana, who was the first person whose story, one of the first stories we have of someone selling their soul to the devil via a contract, when he repented of selling his soul to the devil, apparently, according to the lore, the Virgin Mary flew down to heaven and got the contract out of hell. Or the Virgin Mary... Okay, so according to the lore, the Virgin Mary flew down to hell, grabbed the contract, and pulled it out, thus removing any power the devil had from that agreement. In a similar story in the lore, a man was sold to the devil by his parents when he was still in the womb because they didn't realize his mother was pregnant, and so they entered into agreement with the devil that was sort of ambiguously worded in such a way that he eventually got a claim on the soul of this unborn youngster. And this fellow wanted to become a priest, but he couldn't say a mass until he was able to, like, figure out what to do about this contract. So he actually, through force of personality, supposedly walked down into hell and talked his way into stealing that contract and getting it out. So there's something to be said for the idea that, like, if there is a paper contract, this can affect the ways in which it can be enforced by the devil. But at the same time, a lot of these pacts of the devil are not necessarily in the form of a written contract. In a 1772 trial in the Swedish court system, because they did deal with a fair number, like, I think about at least 29 cases of people entering into deals with the devil. In a 1772 trial, someone was accused of making a pact with the devil, and the only thing he had for the pact was soil from an execution ground that he had kept in a napkin. And I guess he was going to give that to the devil as a sign of his good or evil intentions. There were also, I think, two cases in the Swedish court system in 1698 and 1731 of soldiers who basically made verbal agreements with the devil, so it was sort of like you'd seal it with a handshake, that kind of thing. At least I think these were two separate cases in 1698 and 1731. I'm looking at citations for Swedish court records, so I don't necessarily know with a great deal of certainty what I'm looking at, because I don't speak Swedish, and I am not a lawyer, and I'm especially not a Swedish lawyer. But the thing is, like, when you enter into these verbal sort of contracts with the devil, there are presumably ways you can get out of those as well. There are a number of stories in the lore about people being able to essentially hold the devil to the letter of an agreement and sort of get out of observing the spirit of that agreement. For example, there's a story in Ulrich Jahn's Volkssagen aus Rume und Rügen, in which he tells a story about a priest who sold his soul to the devil for the devil to build a road and a dam through a stretch of mud. And in his agreement, he told the devil, then you shall take my soul where you find it as long as I no longer stand on this my territory. And so the devil built the road and the dam, then waited for him to basically, because he was a priest, step out of his parish, which the devil interpreted as being his territory. And when he did, quote, he pulled his arms, or when he, like, sort of attacked the priest, he, quote, pulled his arms back as if he had sunk his claws in ice, and the pastor laughed out ringingly with great pleasure, replying, oh, you dumb devil, did you think to catch me so easily? Where I walk and stand, there I find myself on my territory, for when I concluded the pact with you, I had laid under the soles of my feet pages from the book of the Holy Gospel, where lie there to this day, and will also not come out as long as I live. Do you now see why you got a fright and a shudder when you wanted to grab me? And then the devil knew that he was no match for the cleverness of the priest, and full of wrath and shame, he cleared off hastily and did not let himself be seen again in the lifetime of the pastor of Starkow. So it is conceivably possible to outwit the devil and get the rewards without going through the punishments. There are a lot of stories like this, though this one in particular does seem a bit biased toward the priest. One does wonder. In a lot of stories of, for example, the devil being told to, a lot of it's sort of infrastructure projects. So, like, the devil is told to build a bridge across the river in exchange for the first soul to cross the river, but then someone pushes a dog across, so he just gets the soul of the dog. We have another story of something sort of similar from Aug Wünsche's 1905 book, Der Sagenkreis von Komprellten Teufel, in which a young girl essentially enters into a pact with the devil where she says that she will give the devil the first bundle she's going to make the next day in exchange for help in spreading manure on some fields. And I guess her parents find out, and so they go to the local priest and they talk to him about him, and he basically tells the maid, okay, so according to Wünsche, the minister made a serious face and counseled her, if she would not be lost, not to tie her petticoat early the next morning, but rather to go into the barn wearing her best shift, and there to tie up a bundle of straw and throw it out the door. The maid followed the advice of the minister. Hardly had she thrown the bundle out the door when the devil seized it and shredded it into 1,000 pieces. So there is sort of something to be said for, get it, because the first bundle she was going to tie the next day was actually going to be around herself in her clothes. So there's something to be said for the idea that if you don't have a legal out in this sort of scenario, you can conceivably try to outsmart the devil. Though it's once again, risky move, would recommend against it. But at the same time, it's difficult to say how much something like that depends absolutely on the wording rather than the intention, because if you sort of move forward into questions of people selling their souls to the devil through time, they do sometimes get less specific. So there's the story that Robert Johnson, the sort of founder of the blues, sold his soul to the devil at a crossroads, and I think people tend to cite his music to some extent to back up that claim, because he has Crossroad Blues, which doesn't, I think, mention the devil at all, and also the Me and the Devil Blues, which is more about domestic violence than is about anything else. Bit of an unsettling tune, to be honest with you. But the thing is, what seems to be the case is actually Robert Johnson, in the story of him selling his soul to the devil to learn to play the blues so well, was probably being confused with Tommy Johnson, a different blues player about whom that sort of story was circulating first, and that this got sort of lashed on to Robert Johnson. So in his great book, Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll, Peter Babergel suggests that in addition to it probably being Tommy Johnson about whom the story was originally told instead of Robert Johnson, who was himself a blues player, it was likely that he also didn't sell his soul to the devil at that crossroads, but rather to a West African Yoruba god, possibly Legba or Eshu, who would be much less destructive and sinister than the satanic figure of the Bible, which is frankly reassuring. But I haven't found any specifics about that agreement in so much as it may have taken place or not, but these sorts of connections between selling your soul to the devil and musicianship do seem to continue more or less up to the present day. In his 2013 memoir, Playing with the Devil, Marcus F. Griffin talks about how his rock band, Entropy, started colluding with this demonic figure who appeared before them in the form of a man with a featureless gray face who would have a sort of circle of blue flame around him on the floor. And he talks about how, essentially, I think, so I haven't finished the book. I've been looking through it very quickly for this show. But he essentially talks about how after colluding with this being, their work, I think their music was getting better, but also things were happening to benefit the band at the expense of other bands. Like, bad things were happening to other people to help them out. And it became this sort of situation where eventually they wanted out. So there's a final confrontation in which they meet a man who calls himself Gabe, and someone in the band realizes that it must be this featureless gray-faced demonic being in another form, and so they kick him out in a confrontation, and they never sign a recording contract. The band really never goes anywhere, but they feel like they got sort of their lives back after this. And at the root of all this is not just the notion that these are musicians sort of selling their souls to a demonic figure, but as far as I can tell, there was never any real formal agreement between the band and this demon being, which in a way is very reassuring, because of course, while that meant that they had no real guarantee of what positive ends they were going to get from this figure, it also indicates that getting out of that deal didn't require outsmarting the devil, it didn't require finding the contract and destroying it. All it really required was them deciding they didn't want to be part of that anymore, which I find, frankly, kind of reassuring to know that unlike sort of with, say, Saint Theophilus, with whom we started all this, like, instead of having a situation where you are getting into a very rigid and complex legal agreement, you are in fact just sort of opting in and opting out if you want to, and it's just a question of, are you getting out too late? And I think that's a good place to close. So yeah, I would say don't sell your soul to the devil. Don't do that. Yeah, and if you have any other questions for this show's research department, please, by all means, email me at intothedarkrfb@gmail.com and catch us with next month's normal show, which will be like a normal live show on the Radio Free Brooklyn stream, and then a podcast where I'll be talking about skinwalkers, which are these evil witches in the Navajo tradition, with somebody who says that there was a skinwalker in his family, which I think is, I mean, like not great for him, but like super cool as a notion. But yeah, so catch us next month, and thanks for listening.